The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show this week. The president made huge news last night. We're going to spend some time talking about the reverberations of his health care reform speech and what it all means going forward. Then we're going to talk a little bit about some secondary agenda issues. Health care reform is kind of squeezing out talk of financial regulatory reform. We'll have a guest on to talk about where things are headed there this fall. And then the Supreme Court had some exciting arguments yesterday on campaign finance reform. We talked about them a little bit last week, and our guest from last week will rejoin us to talk about the arguments and what perhaps they portend for a final decision from the Supreme Court in the world of campaign finance and free speech. But let's start. We've got Marty Kendrick, healthcare policy attorney with us, a frequent contributor to Capital Thinking, here to talk a little bit about the president's speech. Marty, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Fine. Thank you, Kevin.
Well, let's start with, he talked to Congress last night, and I think a lot of people tuned in. It's no football games to compete with and whatnot. Tell us a little bit about his major highlights of his speech.
Well, President Obama used the address to a joint session of Congress to try to take back the initiative, if you will, and refocus the health care debate and clear up confusion from all the backlash that occurred at town hall meetings across the country during the congressional recess in August. Specifically, the president explained how his health care reform plan would make health care more affordable. He tried to make a case in terms of the cost-cutting for both families and small businesses, and he emphasized most of all the cost of not acting now. President Obama noted that his plan would provide more security and stability to those who have insurance, and he also argued and made very strong points about the provision of insurance for those who do not currently have coverage. I think what was most interesting and what a lot of folks were hanging on for was the president's comments about the public plan. And interestingly, he spoke in favor of a public plan very strongly from a personal perspective as an option for those who do not currently have health insurance. But he also stated that the politics of surrounding the public plan should not hold up the ultimate goal of passing a health care reform bill. I thought just to one other footnote or comment, probably most noteworthy, the president's mention that his plan would cost less than what has been spent in Iraq and Afghanistan wars and the tax breaks for wealthy individuals that Congress passed during the last administration. There was a degree of partisanship, I think, in those comments. He confirmed, however, that he would not sign a bill that raised the deficit in the next 10 years or in future out years. He said that the Obama plan, which, by the way, is posted anew on the White House website today, would cost $900 billion over 10 years and would be paid for with money in the existing health care system.
Yeah, let's talk about a couple of your comments. I certainly thought he got very partisan with a couple of those remarks on Iraq and the the tax breaks, whatnot, at a time when you would think he would be reaching out to unite instead of trying to divide. I was surprised by the won't sign something without it being revenue neutral. I think that's going to be difficult. And I was most surprised by what you said about the public option, where he really seemed to be walking a tightrope between I'd like to have it, but maybe if I have to throw it overboard, I will. He didn't want to fall in either side of that alligator pit. So those were kind of my surprises. What was the thing that surprised you most, Marty?
You know, I agree with all of those comments. I guess I was not frankly surprised, and I think this was politically smart to hear President Obama invoke Senator Kennedy's commitment and to share a relatively recent communication between Senator Kennedy and President Obama, and his framing of the issue as a moral imperative. The president, as you may have picked up, stated that at stake are not just the details of policy, but fundamental principles of social justice and character of our country. The president is clearly, you know, framing this as a moral issue in a very public kind of way, and I think that's you know, sort of an interesting surprise. I guess of the substantive portions of the presentation to Congress, what surprised me a little bit is his definite, clear outreach to Republicans. He confirmed in a public kind of way the Republican view that defensive medicine, you know, may be contributing to higher health care costs, and he spoke of his desire to put patient safety first and to let the doctors focus on practicing medicine. He mentioned specifically that the Bush administration had considered authorizing demonstration projects in individual states to test these issues. And he, you know, in the speech actually directed the Secretary of HHS, Secretary Sebelius, to move forward on medical malpractice initiatives immediately. So I think that that's a surprise. I mean, that's definitely, you know, a fast foot forward, and it's a move in advance of the legislation. He obviously wants to get health care reform done now, and, you know, he made several comments that the time for bickering and political games is over, and now is the time to deliver on health care. And I guess I would just mention that I guess I'm not surprised, but I am surprised. There was such warmth in the room, although during the speech, clearly the Republicans, many of the Republicans sat back and, you know, were not participating. There was a lot of goodwill expressed and clapping and overtures from the Republican side as well as the president entered and exited the Congress last night.
Yeah, I don't put as much stock in that as I used to. I think a lot of that's political theater these days. They know the TV cameras are on them, and obviously there was an unfortunate incident. We can talk more about that later. But I was struck by the tone of op-eds this morning and how little perhaps the ground had moved on behalf of in the aftermath of his speech. There just didn't seem to be much give on either side of the editorial pages. So I'm wondering what your sense is of the immediate reaction, both in the public and in the policymakers' eyes on his speech.
Well, I think a lot of the pundits and politicals seem to think that the president gave an effective and straightforward address to the American people. You know, as we sort of alluded to earlier, he really had something for everyone in the speech. I think Democrats overall were pleased and seemed to come away with a renewed determination to get health care reform done this year. I think there was, you know, again, a lot of sensitivity to the comment and positioning related to the public plan. The Republicans, while they were complimentary of his eloquence, were really labeling the speech as very partisan, although I thought that, you know, Senator McCain, for example, took clear delight in his mention of malpractice reform and also his support of offering low-cost coverage to low-income individuals with pre-existing conditions, which, you know, he credited and gave public recognition to Senator McCain's position in the presidential campaign. I do agree that what the president did not really offer up any novel ideas or covered, you know, major new issues, But I don't think his game, the speech was a game changer, as we would say in Washington in the debate. But certainly do believe that it will serve as an impetus to propel Congress to move the ball forward quickly.
Marty, got time for one more question here before we hit the break. Tell me a little bit. Senator Baucus seems to have made some progress in his negotiations on the Finance Committee side. What is his progress, and what are the next steps here?
Well, Senator Baucus has, over Labor Day weekend, released a framework for his Gang of Six, which includes Senator Conrad, Bingaman, Grassley, Enzi, and Snow. He's really hoping to produce a bipartisan bill, but whether or not he has the Republican support, he has unequivocally announced that he is going to release a chairman's mark at the beginning of next week, and that he will go to markup the week of September 21st. So whether the Republicans are on board or not, the legislative process is going to move forward in the Senate. And I think, frankly, that the House leadership, which we've seen a little double messaging, if you will, in the last couple of days between Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Hoyer, where, you know, the Speaker is standing by her initial prediction that the House will pass a bill with a public plan, but Majority Leader Hoyer is saying or signaling that the omission of a public plan should not deter health reform legislation from ultimately passing the Congress. Because there are some very deep divisions between the liberal and more conservative blue Democrats in the House, I think you may see the House sitting back to wait until the Senate acts a bit or get a better clue in terms of what the Senate will be able to move forward with before the House jumps off the ship in terms of moving a bill to the floor.
Marty, let me thank you. You folks want to talk to Marty Kendrick, it's mkendrick@pattenboggs.com. We're going to come back in just a moment to talk about the next big issue on the Obama agenda, that's financial reform. We'll be back in a moment.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball,
off the glass,
football,
come on,
golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, we talked a little bit about health care reform. That is, of course, the major issue of the day, dominating the airwaves here in the nation's capital and around the country, crowding out much of the president's agenda on some other key issues. We continue to struggle along economically, and we wanted to catch up on where the president and Congress are on their financial regulatory reform process. With us is our frequent guest, Micah Green, one of the noted experts in the field of financial services policy work. Micah, how are you? Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. Doing well. Thanks.
Hope you had a good summer break from D.C. and now back in the grind. You know, the perception is that health care reform really took it on the chin when members were home during the month of August. And I guess my question is, has financial services sort of suffered the same death by a thousand paper cuts approach as the president's plan gets attacked at all quarters over the summer, or has progress been made?
I think the answer to that is they're different issues. The healthcare issue was always going to be a more grassroots issue than financial services reform and modernization. Ironically, the two issues in financial services that get the most excitement in the public mind, in the public eye, is executive compensation and the consumer product commission that the administration wants to create, in large part because they affect people on Main Street. People on Main Street understand when they pick up the paper and see that an executive of a company that's lost a lot of money made a whole bunch of money and they're angry about it. Or they understand that when their credit card company increases their rate of interest. Or they understand that the mortgage they thought was a safe, secure mortgage had terms in it they didn't understand. And those things probably do have that public connectivity at the grassroots level and will drive much of the debate on financial services reform. But that really has very little to do with the regulatory reform issues, which are far more complex, far more institutional in nature, and probably make people's eyes glaze over after a couple minutes of talking about it. So I think they're different issues, and I think they have lives of their own.
Ah, very interesting. Yeah, lots to talk about in all that. In this world. One, in my sense, again, this is not a field that I'm expert in, but just in sort of reading the papers over the last month or two, is that since the president rolled out his proposal, which I think was midsummer, there seems to be an awful lot of bureaucratic infighting from the alphabet soup of Washington agencies that already have jurisdiction here saying, hey, you know, let's do all these things, but don't cut into my jurisdiction and power. Is that having an impact on the debate in Congress?
Yes. You know, when this debate first started, people talked about merging banking regulators into one single banking regulator. People talked about federalizing insurance regulation away from the states, the 50 states. People talked about merging the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and the SEC. And now you're looking at a reform package that does some consolidation in the banking side, but not a whole lot, and does not merge the commodities / derivatives and securities regulators. Having said that, though, I think, you know, there are elements of this bill that create a coordinating council of regulators to try to achieve some better harmonization and some better consistency. But if one were to look at a total restructuring of the regulatory environment as major reform, I think that you know, this proposal doesn't go that far.
Now, some interesting political issues this week, Micah. With the death of Senator Kennedy, Chris Dodd, who's the chairman of the Banking Committee, had a chance to jump over and become chairman of Kennedy's old committee and sort of be the quarterback of health care reform in the Senate. He's just announced in the last 48 hours he's going to stay with the Banking Committee. And some of the subsequent shuffling means that Blanche Lincoln, the senior senator from Arkansas, is going to move up to chair the Agriculture Committee, which does have some relationship, actually, to the regulatory world in terms of, I believe, some regulation of some derivatives. And she may have had a different position than Chairman Harkin, who she's succeeding. Talk to me a little bit about the dynamics of what Dodd staying in banking means for all of this. And does Lincoln's ascension to chairman of Ag mean anything for financial reform?
The answer to both questions is yes. You know, Senator Dodd remaining as chairman of the Banking Committee, you know, he's still going to be deeply involved in health care reform. He's invested a great deal of time in health care reform on behalf of his ailing friend, Ted Kennedy, and the amount of time that he's invested in it suggests he probably knows more about it than most senators, and therefore is going to continue to be a leader in that issue. So he will have time pressures, but by remaining chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, it has probably shifted financial services reform from being a goal to being an imperative. Because I do believe that Senator Dodd would not have stayed at banking if he didn't feel he could get something significant done. Whether it's all six or seven elements, whether it's two out of seven or three out of seven, who knows? But I think he's going to take it on and work very hard with his committee, both sides of the aisle. His working relationship with Senator Shelby is stellar, and that should lead to significant progress on most, if not all, of the issues. And how that interrelates with Senator Lincoln from Arkansas, there's no question that Senator Harkin has been a very active legislator in the whole commodities field, and that extended over into the derivative space. And he had some very strong positions on limiting the use of derivatives by market participants, by end users, and the trading of derivatives, and how that interrelated to commodities laws as well. While I can't speak for specifically how Senator Lincoln's positions are on those same issues, she is a part of the moderate Democrats, part of the new Democrats, who have staked out on these sorts of issues a desire to blend, the needs for oversight and regulation with the needs for an open and free marketplace. And so, to the extent that that influences the debate, as the Senate Agriculture Committee and the Senate Banking Committee have to work together on issues such as OTC derivatives, I think you'll see that impact the debate.
Let me shift focus a little bit. I know you spend a lot of your time working on TARP. That seems to have fallen a little bit off, not the radar screen, but it's a little further back in the newspapers these days. But it seems like there have been some interesting announcements and developments just in how those programs are working. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think, if you look at the original TARP program, which was intended to try to get non-performing and distressed assets off the balance sheets of financial institutions, then that morphed into a capital purchase program to infuse, capital into the financial institutions to strengthen their foothold and not worry about the balance sheet holdings, which has then morphed into two programs, one at the FDIC to get legacy loans, whole loans, off of the balance sheets of the firms, and on the Treasury side and the Fed side to create public-private partnerships with the government to get asset-backed securities, mortgage-backed securities, off of the balance sheets of the firms. Those latter programs are still slow going, in large part because we've had a strengthening of the financial position of many of the financial institutions, and their desire to part with some of those assets, particularly at the prices that people are willing to buy them at, is still not clear. And at the end of the day, a financial institution, even if it's a troubled asset on their balance sheet, doesn't want to take a killing on it, because if they take a killing on it now, they have to recognize that loss. So this whole issue when TARP first came out a year ago was whether or not you could value these assets to where the seller wanted to sell them and the buyer wanted to buy them. And ironically, we're still asking those same questions.
We don't need to move too fast. It's just the economy. Related to that, I saw a report this week, that GM and Chrysler may never be able to pay back the money that we've invested in them. Does that have any impact on future policy decisions that Congress and the President might make about supporting industries that are in trouble?
It's hard to say, because if you look at the TARP program in the financial services industry, you know, the money that's been repaid back and the warrants that have been you know, exercised actually has made the government a good deal of money. The program's operated by the Federal Reserve in terms of the guarantees that were provided over the last year have actually, you know, netted the Federal Reserve significant chunk of change. The auto industry, if you look back to the late 70s when Chrysler had its problems back then, that program actually netted the government some money. So I think the jury's still out. I think, you know, the time frame and need for patience for the auto industry is probably going to be different than the financial industry, in large part because of the legacy turnaround that has to happen in the auto industry. And so I think most people will say, you know, keep your powder dry right now. It's too early to make assessments like that. But I think their patience level for the payback on the auto industry is probably a longer term patience level than for the financial industry.
One minute answer here, Micah. Give me the fall forecast for financial services in Congress.
I think the House Financial Services Committee is going to start working on legislation in the committee called a markup, where the legislation is considered, beginning late September, early October. And the first one out of the block will be the Financial Products Consumer Agency, and then they'll move on down the line, probably going to OTC derivatives and down the line. Those bills will either separately or en bloc go to the House floor sometime in November and be sent over to the Senate side. Simultaneously, though, I think the Senate side right now, will be working much more behind the scenes on figuring out what the art of the doable is. And I think you can see both the Democrats and Republicans work together to see what they can and cannot get done. And then it'll be depending on how the process is going in the House side, will determine the schedule for the Senate and also the process.
Micah, many thanks. Appreciate having you on. We'll have you back later this fall to talk about progress. We'll be back in a minute to talk about the limits of free speech and campaign finance reform.
Thanks, Kevin.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Last week, we talked about the Supreme Court argument that took place yesterday regarding the Citizens United case, an important campaign finance reform case. We wanted to bring back our guest from last week, Bill McGinley, who's a campaign finance attorney here in Washington, D.C., and the operator of ExpressAdvocacy.com. It's a great new blog that deals with all things in the political regulatory world. Encourage you to look at that. Bill, welcome back to the show. I know it's been a pretty busy week for you with this case. Let's start from the top. Tell us what happened yesterday.
Well, basically, if you are a student of politics or somebody who works in the campaign finance field, yesterday was the Super Bowl. I mean, you really had an excellent argument before the Supreme Court that really kind of laid out in stark contrast the two positions. Former Solicitor General Ted Olson argued for Citizens United, the plaintiff in the case, and this is the nonprofit organization that produced the film called Hillary, the movie that took a critical view of then-Senator Clinton's public life and tried to place it into movie theaters, run advertisements advertising the availability of the film, but also to place it on video on demand on cable systems nationwide. Well, the FEC came back and said you can't do that because it violates the electioneering communication ban, which is a part of McCain-Feingold that limits corporate speech, and so Citizens United filed the case. Well, yesterday was the re-argument. We had already had one argument in the case in the spring, and the Supreme Court took the unusual move of asking for re-argument on some specific points of law to decide, to determine whether they needed to overrule some prior precedent in order to decide the Citizens United case. The argument was robust, to say the least. The justices were very engaged and really asked some tough questions of the practitioners. The one that I was paying attention to was the new Solicitor General, General Kagan, who came in. This was her first case before the Supreme Court and really came in unusual circumstances, and she did a very good job presenting the government's case. There were a couple of points that I think that the five-member conservative wing of the Supreme Court, which appears to be on the verge of ruling for Citizens United, probably will not appreciate. The first is they revisited the book banning issue. During her arguments, Justice Ginsburg gave her an opportunity at the end to kind of bring up this book banning issue that was so publicized after the first hearing, where the then-Deputy Solicitor General discussed whether the federal government has the authority under the Constitution to ban books if they contain some campaign statements in the book. You could have a 500-page book, but there's one line that says, vote for Congressman McGinley. Whether, you know, if that's published by a corporation, which most publishers are, whether or not the FEC could come in and prohibit that and potentially prosecute somebody for publishing that book. And what the Solicitor General essentially said is that they had changed their position, but that they still believe the statute covers that type of activity. But she claimed before the court that that the FEC has never exercised that authority and gone after anybody for publishing a book. She also conceded that somebody who would find themselves in that circumstance would have a pretty good constitutional challenge.
I thought, Chief Justice Roberts sort of have a devastating quote there that, you know, something along the lines of we've never entrusted our free speech rights with a regulatory agency?
That's right. And Chief Justice Roberts' statement was basically in response to what General Kagan was arguing about the book issue. Because she was saying that they have the authority, but they just haven't decided to pursue anybody under that authority, that's when Chief Justice Roberts came in, which I believe now is the quote of the argument of the hearing. You know, we don't put our First Amendment rights in the hands of FEC bureaucrats.
God love them for that. I might have to get that framed and put that over my door. Well, let me ask you some questions, okay?
Sure.
Let's stick with your Super Bowl analogy. Did you have a ticket to the Super Bowl? Were you in the room for this argument yesterday?
Wasn't able to make it into the room. Unfortunately, my duties as a lawyer precluded me from making it over there, but I was able to listen to the argument in its entirety. It's available on C-SPAN if anybody wants to listen to it.
And that's an extraordinary step the court took to get usually these tapes don't come out quite as quickly as they came out with yesterday. Now, Super Bowl usually has lots of celebrities. My understanding is the court yesterday was packed with its own share of political celebrities. Mitch McConnell, who was one of the key players in campaign finance reform, the authors of the campaign finance reform bill, John McCain and Russ Feingold, who were quick to come out and criticize what they thought the tone of questioning meant for how this case might turn out. But I'm interested in one of the celebrities on the bench, and that's new Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor and what her questions tell you a little bit about her position on this issue.
Well, Justice Sotomayor basically came out and asked questions about a concept that's called stare decisis, which is essentially the Supreme Court having respect for its prior opinions on the issue before the court. And what she was basically asking was, isn't it a radical step for the Supreme Court at this late date, after what the reformers would argue, the corporate contribution and expenditure bans being on the book for a number of years, wouldn't it be a radical step for the court to come back and basically overturn that prior precedent? She also raised the issue of, you know, is this an issue that was properly before the court in the pleadings during the lower court case? And basically, this was one of the lines of questions where it was asked of General Kagan, and what she came back and said was that Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, which is a case from a couple decades ago where the U.S. Supreme Court said that the Michigan statute banning corporations from engaging in independent expenditures was constitutional, and the court cited a number of justifications for upholding the ban. One was that, you know, because of the corporate form, these entities were able to amass great aggregations of wealth, in that their participation in the political marketplace would really distort the political marketplace because they would be able to drown out other participants. And the second one was that, you know, that there is some shareholder issues at stake here because people are buying into the corporation for economic interest, not as an expression of support for the corporation's political views. But then there's also the quid pro quo corruption, or the appearance of corruption. And what General Kagan essentially stated before the court was that the government no longer felt that the distortion argument, the one where corporations are able to amass great wealth because of the state-conferred benefits of the corporate form, that they were essentially not going to pursue that line of reasoning anymore, that they believed that it was not a compelling governmental interest that would support continuing the corporate ban, the ban on corporate speech.
Yeah, now another great quote I sort of saw on this is that, you know, Kagan all but conceded defeat and said something along the lines of, you know, if you're asking, do we want to lose? The answer is no. But if you're telling us we're going to lose, we really have a theory on how we would like to lose, to sort of minimize the damage to the underlying campaign finance laws here. It seems to me, in what I've read and heard, that the court has fairly well telegraphed that we're lining up for a 5-4, 6-3 decision in favor of Citizens United, and the only question that remains is the scope of that decision. So walk us through the two alternatives, what a narrow scope decision might look like and what a broad decision might mean for us.
Well, a narrow decision would simply be limited to the facts of the Citizens United case, that the nonprofit corporation producing the film and wanting to advertise its existence and its availability to the public would not run afoul of the corporate expenditure ban or the electioneering communication provision in McCain-Feingold, and that in order to reach that decision, they essentially needed to overrule Austin and also the McConnell case in order to reach that decision. So you would basically have a piecemeal solution. They would say that this small part, this in this as-applied challenge, the statute is unconstitutional as applied to the facts of the Citizens United case.
And that sort of narrow decision, Bill, is the kind of jurisprudence that Sandra Day O'Connor was known for crafting as a key swing vote on the Supreme Court in the past, and even that Chief Justice Roberts has seemed to view incrementalism as the right approach in many of the constitutional challenges he's dealt with in his limited time on the court as well, right?
That's correct, but I think one of the things that the court may be struggling with is, you know, this will be the second electioneering communication provision case that they've had in 2 years. 2 years ago, they dealt with the same provision in Wisconsin Right to Life, which is where they narrowed the application of the statute to cover only election-related advertisements as opposed to the traditional grassroots lobbying advertisements where you discuss an issue and ask somebody to call an office holder and express their opinion on that issue. Now they have Citizens United under the same exact same provision before the court 2 years later. And it may be that they're taking a look at it and seeing how life has existed under the narrow ruling of Wisconsin Right to Life, and decided, you know, rather than taking 10 years to reach the same result, maybe what we should do is go ahead and correct the situation in one foul swoop.
And now, if they do that, what happens?
Basically, what they could do is they could strike down the electioneering communication ban in its entirety. They could say that the statute is, you know, in the record before the court, the arguments and the briefs submitted by the parties and all of the friend of the court briefs that were submitted as well, that based upon this record, we are going to go ahead and declare that this provision is unconstitutional on its face. And what that could do, and especially if they overrule Austin, is that it may mean that corporations, for-profit corporations, potentially, you know, and non-profit corporations, would be able to run advertisements in close proximity to an election, not only referencing federal office holders and candidates, but may be able to urge some type of election-related action. Such as, you know, voting for, voting against, just supporting somebody, you know, giving somebody a contribution. And so what remains to be seen is, as you said before, you know, most people are speculating that there's a 5-4 decision coming. You know, it could be that Justice Breyer, based upon some of his questions, if there's a more narrow holding within the decision, may cross over, and this is my speculation, may cross over and join the more narrow holding, but then dissent from the broader holding. And so we could have a 5-4, a 6-3, but really what's remains to be seen is the scope of the holding. I think most court observers are now saying that the Citizens United will prevail. Now all we're deciding is how big of a victory is it.
Very interesting. You rarely see people walk out of the court, that all parties, that sure of how it's going to turn out and just not sure what the writing means for the scope of the law going forward. Bill, hit us real fast, 30 seconds on where we can find the latest and greatest about this case on Express Advocacy.
Sure, expressadvocacy.com. We've been blogging on it. I offered some pre-argument thoughts on where I thought the arguments might be going, and also some post-argument thoughts on how I thought the arguments went. One of the things that I highlighted on the blog was the discussion about small business owners. And in these times where healthcare reform, the financial services industry regulation, cap and trade, and some of the other important issues that are being dealt with right now by Congress, one of the benefits or one of the impact of a broad decision could be that you see small business owners engaging in the political debate on these important issues.
Bill, I got to cut you off there because my big corporate owner wants to run a commercial. We'll have you back on when this case comes to a conclusion. We'll be back in just a minute with some political thoughts of the day.
Thanks for having me.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street, to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We had some terrific guests on talking about the big issues of the day. I tell you, nothing tells me that summer has gone away and fall has come than the week we've just had. Washington's a very sleepy town in the month of August. Labor Day hits, and the president comes back, the Congress comes back, and in the space of just a couple of days, we've got this major presidential address, a huge push on health care reform inside the halls of Congress. You got the people up there pulling the all-nighters. You've got a lot of other issues like financial reform that are being kicked back into high gear. You've got the Supreme Court going out of its way to have a special argument on a case that really could make a difference for generations to come. Either way, it's decided on how we're able to communicate our views on political issues of the day. And you just realize that the summer is over, and the hard, tough slog to the finish line for the congressional job to be done in 2009 is now underway. It's a beautiful day here in Washington, D.C., one of those classic fall days. The sun is out. It's nice temperature. It's not hot and sweaty. The humidity has gone away. And as we sit here on September 10th, I'm reminded this today is exactly like the weather we had on September 11th, 2001, that fateful day. And one of the things that surprised me about last night is the president has very few opportunities to have a bully pulpit, a joint appearance before Congress that's carried live on all the TV networks to talk about the important issues of the day. Obviously, he was there to talk about health care. I was very surprised that just 48 hours before the 8th anniversary of the worst terrorist attack on the United States of America, that there wasn't much focus. I don't recall him talking about it at all, frankly. And if he did, then I missed that. But not a little bit of, hey, thanks to our troops out there, we recognize what you're doing. We're trying to work on health care reform for when you get back. Hey, I'm vigilant in trying to protect us on this as this important anniversary comes up. I think the president continues to be very politically vulnerable on defense issues and on terrorism issues due to the decisions he's made on Guantanamo Bay and investigating the CIA and in dealing with foreign nations, both friend and foe. And I was very surprised that he didn't put in a little bit of meat into his thing before he got into health care reform to sort of protect himself down the line against some sort of challenge there. And that leads me really to the point of our segment here today. I am surprised that as we talk about how important health care reform is in the United States, and everybody knows now it's 1/6 of the American economy, et cetera, that we seem to be talking about it politically in a vacuum, as if our changes to the health care process can occur without any impact on the rest of the decisions we make as a nation. I happen to believe, and certainly people can believe otherwise, health care reform is not
the defining issue of our time right now. I'm frankly more concerned about the barbarians at the gate who would like to destroy the American way of life than I am about whether or not we have every last person covered for their twice a year checkup at the doctor. Because frankly, if the barbarians at the gate get in, then we won't have to worry about our copays and deductibles down the line. But reasonable people can disagree there. But I think we all realize that spending on healthcare will force choices in other areas. I happen to think Social Security is a huge issue with the baby boomer generation getting ready to retire. We're not talking about that at all. And at a time when every report that comes down the pipe says that Social Security is going to go bust because there will soon not be enough workers to support the benefits for the baby boomers retiring. Last night, the President of the United States stood up and told us that we're all going to have an all-you-can-eat buffet at the healthcare table. One of the things he promised us last night was insurance plans that include no cap on lifetime benefits. Now, just think about that. No cap on lifetime benefits. Everybody's going to be covered. We're not going to have more doctors and nurses than we have today because we're not spending any real money or effort on that at the moment to get those people trained up. And all-you-can-eat, and somehow that's going to result in cost savings for you and me. I only took a little bit of economics in college. That wasn't in the course I was in. The course I was in talked pretty plainly about supply and demand. It sure seems to me that we're going to have a dramatic increase in demand and no increase in supply, and that's going to cause some major price problems. But again, reasonable people can disagree. What I'm concerned about is we don't talk about the trade-offs of what health care reform means for us. If we do this, what does it mean for us going forward? That, I think, is a problem. There are lots of other issues, Medicare and Medicaid. We don't talk enough about their failures. The president has said that fixing health care reform will fix those things. I don't think there's been enough pushback on that. I don't think we talk about if health care reform does cost us more money in the federal budget, what are we willing to give up for? Are you willing to sacrifice spending on getting a cleaner environment or improving your children's schools or making sure all of America's parks are open, making sure that our roads and bridges are up to speed, having a robust national defense? Reasonable people can disagree about which of those should be our top priorities, but I continue to be intrigued by the fact that we try and talk about health care reform in isolation, not realizing that making the decisions on the scope that the president wants and that the Democratic majority has the power to push through will inevitably cause limits on what we can do with the rest of the American economy and the decisions we'll face in the next few years. Let's talk about Joe Wilson. He's the congressman who got up and said, "You lie," during the president's speech last night. It's been universally condemned, and I think that condemnation is appropriate. News breaking at this hour that Congressman Wilson has refused a bipartisan request from House leaders to make an apology on the House floor. He apologized to the president's chief of staff last night by phone. That apology was accepted. I think Congressman Wilson's making a huge mistake to not get up and apologize on the House floor and get that run on the news. This is a guy who won 54% of the vote 2 years ago in a competitive South Carolina district. This morning, his challenger, the guy who ran against him 2 years ago, announced that since last night he's raised $100,000 in internet contributions to run against this guy again. Congressman Wilson, don't make this a two-day story. Get out there and apologize. You did the wrong thing. Get out there, make sure everybody knows that you're sincerely regret it, or you're going to discover that your voters are going to probably hold you accountable for that decision, and it could very well cost you your career in the United States Congress. I don't like the story. I think you should condemn the decision, but not the guy. I know Joe Wilson. He's a nice guy. This is certainly out of character from the congressman that I know and respect to there, but you can't defend him. But what I think he should also apologize for, so we can get back to the meat of the story. It's not about what one guy yelled out during a speech. There are legitimate disagreements, and we shouldn't allow either political side to caricature those disagreements. I thought the Republican response last night was pretty weak. You have a president of the United States getting up and speaking. I think you have an obligation to put up a senior leader a recognizable name of the Republican Party to talk, Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, John Boehner, House Majority Leader, to talk about the Republican view of health care reform. The congressman that they put up is a well-qualified doctor from Louisiana. He's also a political unknown, and I think that did not serve the minority party to put their best foot forward in that process. A little bit disappointing there. It's going to be an interesting week. Now the president needs to figure out how we can get Democrats to work together. We're going to talk a little bit more about that during our show next week. Hope everybody enjoys the first weekend of the NFL season. I like the Steelers tonight, and I always like the Redskins and the Colts.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.